slave of Queen Omphale of Lydia. She dressed him in women's clothes and made the strongest man in the world sit at her feet, spinning and sewing with his huge hands, while she herself donned his lion skin and brandished his club. Heracles grumbled and groaned, but he did as he was ordered. When his 3 years at last were over, he had learned his lesson of humility. Again he performed his heroic deeds, and his friends were glad to see him back. One of his great friends was Admetus, king of Thessaly, under whom Apollo once had served when he was a slave on earth. To thank Admetus for his kindness, Apollo had persuaded the fates not to cut his thread of life when his time to die had come, as long as Admetus could find someone else willing to die in his stead. That would be easy, thought the king. His faithful men were always saying his life was dearer to them than their own. King Admetus had always been afraid of dying early, for he was very happy with his beautiful queen, Alcestis. The king and the queen were both fond of Heracles and always welcomed him warmly. But one day, when Heracles came to the palace, King Admetus greeted him alone. He looked sad and downcast. When Heracles asked him what was wrong, he said nothing except that a woman of the household had died, and he must go to her funeral. And he left Heracles alone with the servants. They too looked sad. They waited on him in silence and did not answer his questions. Heracles ate, drank, and made merry alone, and at last he grew impatient, grasped one of the servants, and forced him to speak. The servant told him that the time had come for Admetus to die, and he had turned to his men and asked one of them to die in his stead. But now not one of them had been willing. Admetus then went to his parents, who were old and weary of life, and asked them to die in his stead. They, too, refused. But when he returned to his palace, he found Queen Alcestis setting off for the realm of the dead. She loved him so much, she said. She would gladly give her life for him. And the king was so fond of his own life, he let his queen depart. Now the king and all the household were mourning for Alcestis. Heracles shed big tears when he heard this sad story, but, being a man of action, he seized his club, and he strode off to the underworld to force Hades to give Alcestis back. Such a loving wife should not be allowed to die. Heracles did not have to use his club. Cerberus slunk out of the way as he stormed into the palace of Hades. The lord of the dead himself had a cold, unloving queen, and he was so moved when Heracles told him of Alcestis' devotion that he let her go. Heracles brought Queen Alcestis back to King Admetus, and the grief in the palace changed to great joy. Now they all ate, drank, and made merry together, and Alcestis grew famous far and wide as the most devoted wife who ever lived. Heracles, too, wanted a wife, and he chose Deianira, a Caledonian princess, for his bride. Deianira had already been promised to the river god Achelous, but she dreaded the thought of being married to a river god who could change his shape at will. She would never know in which shape her husband would come home at night. She would rather marry the great hero Heracles. The two suitors agreed to wrestle, the victor to have the princess Deianira. Of course, Heracles won. The river god rushed at him in the shape of a bull, and Heracles seized him by a horn and wrenched it off and threw him to the ground before he had time to change into something else. So Heracles and Deianira were married and were very happy together. One day, as they were out traveling, they came to a swollen stream. Heracles forded it with ease, but Deianira was afraid and stood on the bank. Along came the centaur, Nessus, who politely offered to carry her across. But Nessus, like all centaurs, was fond of pretty girls and before he had reached midstream, he made up his mind to carry her off. Once on the other side, he galloped off with her. Deianira screamed for help. Heracles shot a poison arrow at the centaur, and Nessus fell to the ground. Before he died, he whispered to Deianira, "Take some of my blood and save it. If you ever fear that you are losing your husband's love, paint some of the blood on his tunic, and he will love you again." Deianira carefully saved the drops of blood, for she knew well that many a girl would like to steal her magnificent husband. One day, as Heracles was away at war, he won a great victory and sent a messenger home for his best tunic. He wanted to celebrate with his men, but Deianira thought he wanted to make himself handsome for a girl. She painted some of Nessus's blood on the tunic. As soon as Heracles put it on, he felt as though 1,000 fires were burning him. It was not a love potion that Nessus had given Deianira, but the deadly poison of the Hydra from Heracles' arrow mixed with Nessus's blood. Hercules was so strong that the poison could not kill him, but his suffering was unbearable. He ordered his men to build a funeral pyre, spread his lion skin over the top, and lay down on it. Then he gave his bow and deadly arrows to his young friend Philoctetes as a parting gift. As the flames rose around him, a loud thunderclap was heard, and Heracles, by the order of Zeus, rose up to Olympus, reclining on his lion skin. The gods all welcomed Heracles and were glad to have him with them, for the fates had predicted that Olympus would be attacked by a fearful enemy, and the Olympians could be saved only if the strongest man ever born fought on their side. The prediction soon came to pass. In a last effort to defeat the mighty thunder god Zeus, Mother Earth had given birth to 50 snake-legged giants who surrounded Olympus and tried to storm the palace. They seemed unconquerable, for like Antaeus, whom Heracles had fought on Earth, they sprang up, revived, as soon as they touched the Mother Earth. Heracles knew what to do, and with his help, the gods won over the giants and cast them down into the dismal pit of Tartarus. Heracles was now the hero of Mount Olympus, beloved by all the gods. Even Hera begged him to forgive her, and gave him her daughter Hebe, goddess of eternal youth, for his Olympian bride. From then on, Heracles lived in eternal bliss, forever a joy to the gods. His father Zeus was very pleased.
The Muses sang of Heracles and his labors, and they also sang of the island of Crete, ruled by King Minos, the son of Zeus and Europa. His queen, Pasiphae, a daughter of the sun god Helios, had a golden glimmer in her eyes, like all the descendants of the sun, and was accustomed to great magnificence. King Minos wanted his queen to live in a palace as splendid as her father's, and he ordered Daedalus, an Athenian architect, an inventor of marvelous skill, to build the great palace of Cnossus. The palace rose up story upon story over a forest of columns. Winding stairs and intricate passageways connected the many halls and courtyards. Pictures were painted on the walls of the great halls. Fountains splashed in the courtyards, and the bathrooms even had running water. Bull's horns of the purest gold crowned the roofs, for the Cretans worshipped the bull, since Zeus, in the shape of a bull, had brought Europa to the island. Here the king and the queen and all their court lived in great splendor and happiness, until one day Poseidon sent a snow-white bull from the sea. Since the island of Crete was completely surrounded by his domain, the sea, he too wanted to be honored, and ordered King Minos to sacrifice the bull to him. But Queen Pasiphae was so taken by the beauty of the white bull that she persuaded the king to let it live. She admired the bull so much that she ordered Daedalus to construct a hollow wooden cow, so she could hide inside it and enjoy the beauty of the bull at close range. Poseidon was very angry, and for punishment he made the bull mad. It ravaged the whole island, and though the Cretans were great bullfighters, no one could subdue the beast until Heracles had come to capture it for one of his labors. To punish the king and queen, Poseidon caused Pasiphae to give birth to a monster, the Minotaur. He was half man, half bull, and ate nothing but human flesh. Such a fearful monster could not go free, and the clever Daedalus constructed for him a labyrinth under the palace. It was a maze of passageways and little rooms from which nobody could ever hope to find his way out. There the Minotaur was shut in, and as long as he was provided with victims to devour, he kept quiet. When he was hungry, he bellowed so loudly that the whole palace shook. King Minos had to wage war with the neighboring islands so he could supply the Minotaur with the prisoners of war for food. When a son of Minos visited Athens and was accidentally killed, King Minos used this as an excuse to threaten to sack the city unless 7 Athenian maidens and 7 Athenian youths were sent to Crete to be sacrificed to the Minotaur every 9 years. To save his city, Aegeus, the king of Athens, had to consent, for Minos was much stronger than he. The people of Athens grumbled, for while King Aegeus was childless and had nothing to lose, they had to see their sons and daughters sacrificed to the cruel Minotaur. 2 times 9 years had passed, and the king was growing old. For the 3rd time, a ship with black sails of mourning was due to depart, when word came to the king that a young hero, Theseus, from Troezen, was making his way to Athens, destroying all the monsters and highwaymen he met on the road. When King Aegeus heard that, his old heart beat faster. Once in his youth he had visited Troezen and had been secretly married to Princess Aethra. He did not bring Aethra back to Athens with him, but before he left he said to her, "Should you bear me a son, and should he grow up strong enough to lift this boulder, under which I hide my sword and golden sandals, send him to me, for then he will be the worthy heir to the throne of Athens." King Aegeus in those days was known for his great strength. Theseus, the young hero, arrived in Athens and went straight to the king's palace. Tall and handsome, he stood before Aegeus with the sandals and the sword, and the king was overjoyed. At last he had a son who was a hero as well. The king happily proclaimed Theseus the rightful heir to the throne of Athens, and he became the hero of all Athens when he offered to take the place of one of the victims who were to be sent to Crete. Old King Aegeus begged his son not to go, but Theseus would not change his mind. "I shall make an end of the Minotaur, and we shall return safely," he said. "We sail with black sails, but we shall return with white sails as a signal of my success." The ship sailed to Crete, and the 14 young Athenians were locked in a dungeon to await their doom. But King Minos had a lovely daughter, Ariadne, as fair a maiden as eyes could see. She could not bear the thought that handsome Theseus should be sacrificed to the ugly Minotaur. She went to Daedalus and begged for help to save him. He gave Ariadne a magic ball of thread and told her that at midnight, when the Minotaur was fast asleep, she must take Theseus to the labyrinth. The magic ball of thread would roll ahead of him through the maze and lead him to the monster. And then it was up to Theseus to overpower the beast. In the dark of night, Ariadne went to Theseus's prison and whispered that, if he would promise to marry her and carry her away with him, she would help him. Gladly Theseus gave his word, and Ariadne led him to the gate of the labyrinth, tied the end of the thread to the gate so he would find his way back, and gave him the ball. As soon as Theseus put the ball of thread on the ground, it rolled ahead of him through dark corridors, upstairs, downstairs, and around winding passageways. Holding on to the unwinding thread, Theseus followed it wherever it led him, and before long he heard the thunderous snoring of the Minotaur. And there, surrounded by skulls and bleached bones, lay the monster fast asleep. Theseus sprang at the Minotaur. It roared so loudly that the whole palace of Cnosus shook. But the monster was taken by surprise, and so strong was Theseus that, with his bare hands, he killed the cruel Minotaur. Theseus quickly followed the thread back to Ariadne, who stood watch at the gate. Together they freed the other Athenians and ran to their ship in the harbor. Before they sailed, they bored holes in all of King Minos's ships so he could not pursue them. Ariadne urged them to hurry, for even she could not save them from Talos, the bronze robot who guarded the island. If he could see their ships leaving, he would throw rocks at it and sink it. Should one of them manage to swim ashore, Talos would throw himself into a blazing bonfire until he was red hot. Then he would burn the survivor to ashes in a fiery embrace. They could already hear his clanking steps when just in time they hoisted their sail and a brisk wind blew them out to sea. In their rush, they forgot to hoist the white sail of victory instead of the black sail of mourning. Theseus's heart was filled with joy. Not only had he saved the Athenians from the Minotaur, he was also bringing a beautiful bride home to Athens. But in the middle of the night, the god Dionysus appeared to him and spoke, "I forbid you to marry Ariadne. I myself have chosen her for my bride. You must set her ashore on the island of Naxos." Theseus could not oppose an Olympian god. When they came to Naxos, he ordered everyone to go ashore and rest. There, Ariadne fell into a heavy slumber, and while she slept, Theseus led the others back to the ship, and they sailed off without her. Poor Ariadne wept bitterly when she awoke and found herself deserted. Little did she suspect that the handsome stranger who came walking toward her was the god Dionysus, and that it was he who had ordered Theseus to abandon her. The god gently dried her tears and gave her a drink from the cup in his hand, and right away the sadness left her. She smiled up at the god, and he put a crown of sparkling jewels on her head and made her his bride. They lived happily together for many years, and their sons became kings of the surrounding islands. Dionysus loved Ariadne greatly, and when she died, he put her jeweled crown into the sky as a constellation so she would never be forgotten. Theseus, in his grief at having lost Ariadne, again forgot to hoist the white sail. When King Aegeus saw the black-sailed ship returning from Crete, he threw himself into the sea in despair. Theseus inherited his father's throne, and he and all of Athens mourned the loss of the old king, and in his honor named the sea in which he had drowned the Aegean. King Minos was beside himself with fury when he discovered that his daughter had fled with the Athenians. He knew that no one but the brilliant Daedalus could have helped Theseus unravel the mystery of the labyrinth. So Daedalus was kept a prisoner in the palace and treated very harshly. Daedalus could not bear to be locked up and let his talents go to waste. Secretly he made two sets of wings, one pair for himself and one pair for his son Icarus. They were cleverly fashioned of feathers set in beeswax. He showed his son how to use them, and warned him not to fly too high, or the heat of the sun would melt the wax. Then he led him up to the highest tower, and flapping their wings they flew off like two birds. Neither King Minos nor Talos, the robot, could stop their flight. Young and foolish, Icarus could not resist the temptation to rise ever higher into the sky. The whole world seemed to be at his feet. He flew too close to the sun, and the wax began to melt. The feathers came loose, the wings fell apart, and Icarus plunged into the sea and drowned. Sadly, Daedalus flew on alone and came to the island of Sicily. His fame had flown ahead of him, and the king of Sicily welcomed him warmly, for he too wanted a splendid palace and bathrooms with running water. As soon as King Minos's ships were mended, he set off in pursuit of Daedalus, the cunning craftsman. He sailed east and he sailed west, and when he came to the Sicilian shore and saw the wondrous palace going up, he had no doubts who was building it. But the king of Sicily hid Daedalus and denied that he had him in his service. Slyly, King Minos sent a conch shell up to the palace, with a message that, if anyone could pull a thread through the winding of the conch, he would give him a sack of gold as a reward. The king of Sicily asked Daedalus to solve the problem. Daedalus thought for a while. Then he tied a silken thread to an ant, put the ant at one end of the conch shell, and a bit of honey at the other end. The ant smelled the honey and found its way through the conch, pulling the thread along with it. When King Minos saw this, he demanded the immediate surrender of Daedalus, for now he had proof that the king of Sicily was hiding him. Nobody but Daedalus could have threaded the conch. The king of Sicily had to give in. He invited Minos to a feast, promising to surrender Daedalus. As was the custom, King Minos took a bath before the feast, but when he stepped into the fabulous bath that Daedalus had built, boiling water rushed out of the tap and scalded him to death. And Daedalus remained for the rest of his life at the court of the king of Sicily. After the death of King Minos, there was peace between Crete and Athens, and Theseus married Phaedra, Ariadne's younger sister. He became the greatest king Athens ever had, and his fame as a hero spread all over Greece. Another great hero, Pirithous, king of the Lapith people in northern Greece, was his inseparable friend. The first time the two heroes had met, they faced each other in combat. But each was so impressed by the other that instead of fighting, they dropped their weapons and swore eternal friendship. Together they performed many great deeds. And when Pirithous married a Lapith princess, Theseus, of course, was invited to the wedding feast. The centaurs were invited too, for though wild and lawless, they were nonetheless distant relatives. At first they behaved quite mannerly, but as the wine jugs were passed around, they became boisterous and rowdy. Suddenly a young centaur sprang up, grasped the bride by the hair, and galloped away with her. At that, the other centaurs each grasped a screaming girl and took her to the hills. Theseus and Pirithous, with their men, set off in swift pursuit and soon caught up with the centaurs. There was a brutal battle, for the wild centaurs tore up big trees and swung them as clubs. But in Theseus and Pirithous, they had found their masters. They were chased out of Greece, and the victorious heroes, with the bride and other Lapith girls, returned to the feast. Pirithous lived happily for a while. Then he became a widower and asked his friend Theseus to help him win a new bride. Theseus vowed to help him, but shuddered when he heard that Pirithous wanted no one less than Persephone, the queen of the dead. She was unhappy with Hades, he said. Since Theseus had promised to help his friend, and a promise could not be broken, he descended to the underworld with Pirithous. They forced their way past Cerberus and entered the gloomy palace. Hades glowered at the two heroes who had dared to enter his realm. But he listened politely while they stated their errand. "Sit down on that bench," he said, "so we can discuss the matter." Grim Hades smiled as the two friends sat down, for it was a magic bench from which no one could ever rise. There they were to sit forever, with ghosts and bats flitting about their heads. A long time later, Heracles came to Hades on an errand and pitied the two heroes trying vainly to get up from the bench. He took hold of Theseus and tore him loose with a mighty tug. But when he tried to free Pirithous, there came a loud earthquake. The gods did not allow Heracles to set him free, for he had shown too great irreverence by daring to want a goddess for a wife. Theseus returned to Athens wiser but thinner, for a part of him had remained stuck to the bench. Ever since, the Athenians have had lean thighs.
One day, a blind old man came to Theseus and asked for permission to stay in his kingdom and die in peace. No one dared let him stay in their country, for he was pursued by the avenging Furies, the Erinnyes. Homeless, he wandered about. The old man, whose name was Oedipus, then told Theseus his sad story. His misfortunes had started before he was born. His father, King Laius of Thebes, had been told by the Oracle of Delphi that the child his queen, Jocasta, was carrying, was fated to kill his father and marry his mother. This must never happen, thought the king, so when Oedipus was born, he ordered a servant to take the child away and abandon him in the mountains. But destiny had willed it differently. A shepherd from the neighboring kingdom of Corinth heard the child's cries. He picked up the little boy and carried him to his king. The king and queen of Corinth were childless, and happily they adopted the handsome little boy. They loved him dearly, and he never knew that he was not their real son. Without a care in the world, he grew to manhood, and one day went to Delphi to find what the future had in store for him. Great was his horror when he heard the words of the oracle. He was destined to kill his father and marry his mother. This must never happen, thought Oedipus. He took destiny in his own hands and fled across the mountains, never to see his dear parents again. On a narrow mountain path he met the chariot of a haughty lord. "Give way for our master's chariot," shouted the servants, and tried to push Oedipus off the path. Angrily, Oedipus fought back, and in the struggle the lord and all his servants were killed, except for one who escaped. Oedipus continued on his way and came to the city of Thebes, but its seven gates were closed. Nobody dared enter or leave, for a monster, the Sphinx, had settled on a cliff just outside the city wall. This winged monster, with a woman's head and a lion's body, challenged all who passed by to solve her riddle. If they couldn't, she tore them to pieces. Nobody yet had solved the riddle of the Sphinx. What creature is it that walks on 4 feet in the morning, on 2 at noon, and on 3 in the evening? She asked with a sinister leer when she saw Oedipus. It is man, Oedipus answered. As a child he crawls on 4, when grown he walks upright on 2 feet, and in old age he leans on a staff. The Sphinx let out a horrible scream. Her riddle was solved and she had lost her powers. In despair, she threw herself to her death. The gates of Thebes burst open, and the people crowded out to thank the stranger who had freed them. Their old king had recently been killed, leaving no son to inherit the throne, and when they heard that Oedipus was a prince from Corinth, they asked him to marry their widowed queen and become their king. To be sure, Queen Jocasta was much older than Oedipus, but she was still beautiful, for she wore a magic necklace that the gods had given Harmonia, the first queen of Thebes. Those who wore that necklace stayed young and beautiful all their lives. Thus Oedipus became king of Thebes, and he ruled the city justly and wisely for many years. One day the news reached him that the king of Corinth had died the peaceful death of old age, and while he mourned his father, he was glad that he had been spared from a terrible destiny. Shortly afterwards, a pestilence broke out in Thebes, and people died in great numbers. Oedipus sent for a seer and asked how he could save his people. "The pestilence would last until the death of the old king had been avenged," said the seer. Oedipus swore that he would find the man who had killed the old king and put out his eyes. He sent his men to search till they found the one surviving servant of King Laius's party. When he was brought before King Oedipus, the servant recognized him at once as the slayer of the old king. And now the whole terrible truth came out, for he was the selfsame servant who had abandoned the infant Oedipus in the mountains, and had known all the while that the child had been found and adopted by the king of Corinth. In despair, Queen Jocasta went to her room and took her own life, and Oedipus in horror put out his own eyes and left Thebes a broken old man. His daughter Antigone went with him, and they wandered from place to place, turned away from every city, till at last they came to Athens. "Not cursed, but blessed, will be the place where you lie down and close your eyes," said Theseus when he had heard the story. "No man could have tried harder than you to escape his destiny." The avenging Erinyes, who had been chasing him, now dropped their whips, and Oedipus could die in peace. His two sons, Eteocles and Polynices, had no regard for the sufferings of their father. They stayed in Thebes and fought over the throne. At last they agreed to take turns being king, 1 year at a time. Eteocles ruled Thebes first, and when his year was up, he refused to give up the throne. Polynices left Thebes in a rage, taking with him the magic necklace of Harmonia, vowing to return with an army and take his rightful throne by force. He went to his father-in-law, the king of Argos, and tried to persuade him to send an army to Thebes. The king had an aging and very vain sister who had great influence over him. Polynices promised her the magic necklace of Harmonia, which would make her young and beautiful again if she could persuade her brother to go against Thebes. So great are the powers of a vain woman that not only the king of Argos and his men, but 7 armies of brave men sent forth with Polynices to storm the 7 gates of Thebes, most of them never to return. Neither could the 7 armies storm the 7 gates of Thebes, nor could the Thebans drive the attackers away. So it was decided that the 2 brothers should fight in single combat, the winner to be king. Eteocles gave his brother a mortal wound, but Polynices, before he fell, dealt him a deadly blow in return. Side by side they lay dead on the field, and all the bloodshed had been in vain. The son of Eteocles became king of Thebes, and Harmonia's necklace, which had brought so much misfortune, was hung up in a temple in Delphi so no woman would ever wear it again.
The muses sang about handsome Jason and his quest for the golden fleece. Jason of Iolcus was as strong and well-bred as he was handsome, for he had been raised by the wise centaur Chiron. Jason's father had brought the boy to the centaur and asked him to bring him up, for he feared that his own brother Peleus, who had taken from him the throne of Iolcus, might harm his heir. In Chiron's lonely mountain cave, young Jason was raised to be a hero, skilled in all manly sports. When he was grown, he left his foster father to go to Iolcus and reclaim his father's throne. Hera, who was paying a visit to Earth, saw the handsome youth as he walked down from the mountain. His golden hair hung to his shoulders, and his strong body was wrapped in a leopard skin. Hera was taken by his fine looks. She quickly changed herself into an old crone and stood helplessly at the brink of a swollen stream as if she did not dare to wade across. Jason offered politely to carry her and lifted her on his strong shoulders. He started to wade, and at first she was very light. But with each step she grew heavier, and when he reached midstream, she was so heavy, his feet sank deep into the mud. He lost one of his sandals, but struggled bravely on, and when he reached the other side, the old crone revealed herself as the goddess Hera. "Lo," she said, "you are a mortal after my liking. I shall stand by you and help you win back your throne from your uncle Peleus." This was a promise the goddess gladly gave, for she had a grudge against Peleus, who had once forgotten to include her when he sacrificed to the gods. Jason thanked her and went on his way in high spirits. When he arrived in Iolcus, people crowded around him, wondering who the handsome stranger might be, but when King Peleus saw him, his cheeks paled. An oracle had predicted that a youth with only one sandal would be his undoing. Peleus feigned great friendship when Jason said who he was and why he had come, but underneath he held dark thoughts and planned to do away with his guest. Peleus feasted Jason and flattered him and promised him the throne as soon as he had performed a heroic deed to prove himself worthy of being a king. "In the kingdom of Colchis, at the shores of the Black Sea," said Peleus, "on a branch in a dark grove, there hangs a golden fleece, shining as brightly as the sun. Bring the fleece to me, and the throne shall be yours." The golden fleece was once the coat of a flying ram sent by Zeus to save the life of young Prince Phrixus of Thessaly. The crops had failed, and Phrixus' evil stepmother had convinced his father that he must sacrifice his son to save his country from famine. Sadly, the king built an altar and put his son on it. But Zeus hated human sacrifice, and as the king lifted his knife, a golden ram swooped down from the skies and flew off with Phrixus on his back. They flew far to the east and landed in the kingdom of Colchis. The king of Colchis understood that Phrixus had been sent by the gods. He gave him his daughter in marriage and sacrificed the ram. Its glittering fleece was hung in a sacred grove, and it was the greatest treasure of the country. King Peleus was certain that Jason would not return alive, for he knew that the warlike king of Colchis would not part with the fleece, and that a never-sleeping dragon was guarding it. But Peleus did not know that Jason had Hera's help.
"Give me timber and men to build for me a sturdy ship, and I shall sail off at once," said Jason. The king gave him what he asked for, and a great ship, the Argo, was built. It was the most seaworthy ship ever seen. Athena herself, prodded by Hera, put a piece of sacred oak in its prow. The oak had the power to speak in time of danger and advise Jason what to do. With a ship like that, it was not hard for Jason to gather a crew of heroes. Even Heracles came with his young friend Hylas. Calais and Zetes, winged sons of the north wind, joined, and Orpheus came along to inspire the crew with his music. Soon each of the 50 oars of the ship was manned by a hero who swore to stand by Jason through all dangers. Before they set sail, the heroes who called themselves the Argonauts sacrificed richly to the gods and made sure to forget no one. Poseidon was in a good mood. He called for the west wind, and under full sail the Argo sped toward the east. When the wind grew tired and died down, the Argonauts put out their oars and rowed with all their might. Orpheus beat out the time with his lyre, and the ship cut through the waves like an arrow. One after the other, the heroes grew tired and pulled in their oars. Only Heracles and Jason were left rowing, each trying to outlast the other. Jason finally fainted, but just as he slumped forward, Heracles' huge oar broke in two, so equal glory was won by them both. The Argonauts landed at a wooded coast, so Heracles could cut himself a new oar. While Heracles searched for a suitable tree, his young friend Hylas went to a pool to fill his jar with fresh water. When the nymph of the pool saw the handsome boy bending down, she fell in love with him. She pulled him down with her to the bottom of the pool, and Hylas vanished forever without leaving a trace. Heracles went out of his mind with grief when he could not find his friend. He ran through the woods calling for Hylas, beating down whatever was in his way. The Argonauts, brave as they were, all feared Heracles when he was struck with folly. They hastily boarded the ship and sailed away without him. On toward the east the Argonauts sailed until they came to a country ruled by a king who was known for his knowledge and wisdom. They went ashore to ask the way to Colchis, but the king was so weak that he could barely answer their questions. He was so thin that only his skin held his bones together. Whenever food was set before him, three disgusting harpies, fat birds with women's heads, swooped down and devoured it. What they did not eat they left so foul and filthy that it was not fit to be eaten. No one in his kingdom could keep the harpies away. The Argonauts felt sorry for the starving king. They told him to have his table set, and when the harpies swooped down again, Zetes and Calais, the sons of the north wind, took to their wings. They could fly faster than the harpies, and when they caught them, they whipped the evil pests so hard that they barely escaped with their lives. The harpies flew to the south, never to be seen again. At last the famished king could eat in peace. He could not thank the Argonauts enough, and told them how to set their course and what dangers they would encounter. No ship had yet been able to reach the shores of Colchis, he said, for the passage to the Black Sea was blocked by two moving rocks. The rocks rolled apart and clashed together, crushing whatever came between them. But if a ship could move as fast as a bird in flight, it might get through. He gave Jason a dove and told him to send the bird ahead of the ship. If the dove came through alive, they had a chance, he said. If not, they had better give up and turn back. The Argonauts took leave of the king and sailed toward the clashing rocks. From afar they could hear the din, and the heroes trembled. But as the rocks rolled apart, Jason released the dove, and the bird flew between them like a dart. Only the very tips of its tail feathers were clipped off when the rocks clashed together. "All men to their oars!" Jason shouted. Orpheus grasped his lyre and played, and his music inspired the heroes to row as never before. The Argo shot ahead like an arrow when the rocks rolled apart, and only the very end of its stern was crushed as they clashed together. Again the rocks rolled apart and stood firmly anchored. The spell was broken, and from then on ships could safely sail in and out of the Black Sea. The Black Sea was a dangerous sea to sail upon, and Hera had her hands full guiding the Argonauts through perils. But with her help, Jason brought his ship safely through raging storms, past pirate shores and Cannibal Island, and the Argonauts finally arrived at Colchis. Aeetes, king of Colchis, a son of Helios, the sun, was a very inhospitable king. In fact, he was so inhospitable that he killed all foreigners who came to his country. When he saw the Argo landing, he was furious. And when Jason led his men to his palace and said that they were all great heroes and had come to offer the king their services in return for the golden fleece, he fumed with rage. "Very well," he said to Jason. "Tomorrow, between sunrise and sunset, you must harness my fire-breathing bulls, plow up a field, and sow it with dragon's teeth, as Cadmus did at Thebes. If you succeed, the golden fleece is yours. But if you fail, I shall cut out the tongues and lop off the hands of you and all your great heroes." King Aeetes knew well that no man could withstand the searing heat that blew from the bull's nostrils. What he did not know was that Hera was helping Jason. Hera knew that the king's daughter Medea, who stood at her father's side with modestly downcast eyes, was the only one who could save Jason. She was a lovely young sorceress, a priestess of the witch goddess Hecate, and must be made to fall in love with Jason. So Hera asked Aphrodite to send her little son Eros to shoot one of his arrows of love into Medea's heart. Aphrodite promised Eros a beautiful enamel ball, and he shot an arrow into Medea's heart just as she lifted up her eyes and saw Jason. Her golden eyes gleamed. Never had she seen anyone so handsome. She just had to use her magic and save him from her cruel father. There was nothing she would not do to save Jason's life. She went to Hecate's temple and implored the witch goddess to help her, and guided by the witch goddess, she concocted a magic salve so powerful that for one day neither iron nor fire could harm the one who was covered with it. In the dark of night, Medea sent for Jason. When he came to the temple, she blushingly told him that she loved him so much she would betray her own father to save him. She gave him the magic salve and told him to go up to the fire-breathing bulls without fear. Jason took the young sorceress in his arms and swore by all the gods of Olympus to make her his queen and love her to his dying day. Hera heard him and nodded, very pleased. When the sun rose in the morning, Jason went straight up to the fire-breathing bulls. They bellowed and belched flames at him, but with Medea's salve, he was invulnerable and so strong that he harnessed the bulls and drove them back and forth till the whole field was plowed. Then he seated the dragon's teeth, and right away a host of warriors sprang up from the furrows. As Cadmus had done, he threw a rock among them and watched from afar as they killed one another. Before the sun had set, they all lay dead. Jason had fulfilled his task, but King Aeetes had no intention of keeping his part of the bargain. He called his men together and ordered them to seize the Argo and kill the foreigners at daybreak. In secrecy, Medea went to Jason and told him that he must take the golden fleece, now rightfully his, and flee from Colchis before dawn. Under cover of night, she led him to the dark grove where the golden fleece, shining like the sun, hung on a branch of a tree. Around the trunk of the tree, lay coiled the never-sleeping dragon. But Medea chanted incantations and bewitched the dragon. She stared at it with her golden eyes, and it fell into a deep magic sleep. Quickly, Jason took the golden fleece and ran with Medea to the waiting Argo, and quietly they slipped out to sea. At daybreak, when the king's men were to attack the ship, they found it was gone. So were the golden fleece and the king's daughter Medea. Red-faced with fury, Aeetes set off in pursuit with his great fleet of Colchian warships. He wanted the golden fleece back, and he wanted to punish his daughter. The fastest of his ships, steered by one of his sons, soon overtook the Argo. The Argonauts thought themselves lost, but again Medea saved them. She called to her brother, who stood at the helm of his ship, and pretended to be sorry for what she had done. She said she would go home with him if he would meet her alone on a nearby island. At the same time, she whispered to Jason to lie in wait and kill her brother when he came. She knew that her father would have to stop the pursuit to give his son a funeral.
Hera and all the gods looked in horror at Medea, stained with her brother's blood. No mortal could commit a worse crime than to cause the death of his own kin. Zeus, in anger, threw thunderbolts. Lightning flashed, thunder roared, and the sea foamed. Then the sacred piece of oak in the bow of the Argo spoke. "Woe," it said, "woe to you all. Not a one of you will reach Greece unless the great sorceress Circe consents to purify Medea and Jason of their sin." Tossed about by howling winds and towering waves, the Argonauts sailed in search of Circe's dwelling. At long last, off the coast of Italy, they found her palace. Medea warned the Argonauts not to leave the ship, for Circe was a dangerous sorceress who amused herself by changing men who came to her island into the animal nearest to the nature of each man. Some became lions, some rabbits, but most of them were changed into pigs and asses. Medea took Jason by the hand so no harm could befall him and went ashore. Circe was Medea's aunt. Like all the descendants of Helios, the sun, she had a golden glint in her eyes, and the moment she saw Medea, she recognized her as her kin. But she was not happy to see her niece, for through her magic, she knew what Medea had done. Still, she consented to sacrifice to Zeus and ask him to forgive Medea and Jason for their crime. The scented smoke of her burnt offerings of sweetmeats and cakes reached Zeus and put him in a good humor. He listened to Circe's words and again smiled down upon Medea and Jason. They thanked Circe and rushed back to the ship. The Argonauts rejoiced. Now they could set sail for Greece. But still they had to pass through dangerous and bewitched waters. Soon they came to the island of the Sirens. The Sirens were half birds, half women, not loathsome like the harpies, but enchanting creatures. They sat on a cliff, half hidden by sea spray, and sang so beautifully that all sailors who heard them dived into the sea and tried to swim to them, only to drown or pine to death at the Sirens' feet. When the alluring voices of the Sirens reached the ears of the Argonauts, Orpheus grasped his lyre and sang so loudly and sweetly that all other sounds were drowned out, and not one of the Argonauts jumped overboard. After a while, the Argo had to sail through a narrow strait that was guarded by two monsters. On one side lurked the monster Scylla. From her waist up, she looked like a woman, but instead of legs, six furious, snarling dogs grew out from her hips, and they tore to pieces whatever came close to them. The monster Charybdis lived on the other side of the strait. She was forever hungry, and sucked into her gullet all ships that ventured within her reach. Helplessly, the Argo drifted between the two monsters, and the Argonauts again gave themselves up for lost, when up from the bottom of the sea rose the playful Nereids. They had come at Hera's bidding, and they lifted up the Argo and threw it from hand to hand over the dangerous waters until they reached the open sea beyond. Poseidon called for the west wind, and the Argo sped homeward under full sail. A loud cheer rang out from the valiant crew when they sighted the shore of Greece. They had been away for many long years and were homesick. But as the Argo neared the port of Iolcus, the ship was hailed by a fisherman who warned Jason that King Peleus had heard of his safe return and had made plans to kill him. Jason was downcast at his uncle's treachery, but Medea, her eyes flashing, asked to be set ashore alone. Once again, she wanted to save his life. Disguised as an old witch, she entered Iolcus, saying that she had magic herbs to sell that would make old creatures young again. The people crowded around her, wondering from where the witch had come. King Peleus himself came out from his palace and asked her to prove that what she said was true, for he felt he was growing old. "Bring me the oldest ram in your flock, and I will show you the magic of my herbs," said Medea. An old ram was brought to her, and she put it into a cauldron full of water. On top she sprinkled some of her magic herbs, and lo, the water in the cauldron boiled, and out of the steam and the bubbles sprang a frisky young lamb. Now King Peleus asked Medea to make him young, too. She answered that only his daughters could do that, but she would gladly sell them her magic herbs. But the herbs she gave them had no magic at all, and so King Peleus found his death in the boiling cauldron at his own daughter's hands. Now the throne of Iolcus was Jason's, but again, Medea had committed a terrible crime. She had tricked innocent daughters into killing their own father. The gods turned from her, and she changed from a lovely young sorceress into an evil witch. The people of Iolcus refused to accept her for their queen and took another king in Jason's stead. With the loss of his throne, Jason also lost his love for Medea. He forgot that he had sworn to love her till his dying day, and that she had committed her crimes for his sake. He asked her to leave, so he could marry the princess of Corinth and inherit her father's kingdom. Medea, scorned and furious, turned more and more to evil sorcery. To revenge herself on Jason, she sent a magic robe to his new bride. It was a beautiful gown, but the moment the bride put it on, she went up in flames, and so did the whole palace. Then Medea disappeared into a dark cloud, riding a carriage drawn by two dragons. Jason found no more happiness, for when he broke his sacred oath to Medea, he lost Hera's goodwill. His good looks left him, and so did his luck and his friends. Lonesome and forgotten, he sat one day in the shade of his once glorious ship, the Argo, now rotting on the beach of Corinth. Suddenly, the sacred piece of oak in the prow broke off, fell on him, and killed him. The golden fleece was hung in Apollo's temple in Delphi, a wonder for all the Greeks to behold, and a reminder of the great deeds of Jason and the Argonauts.
Meleager of Caledonia was one of the heroes who had sailed with Jason on the Argo. No one could throw a spear with greater skill than he. Still, he was powerless to stop a fearful boar that was ravaging his father's kingdom. The king one day had forgotten to include Artemis when he sacrificed to the gods, and in revenge the angry goddess sent the biggest boar ever seen. The boar had tusks as big as an elephant's and bristles as sharp as steel. Meleager sent for the Argonauts and all the great athletes of Greece and asked them to come to Caledonia and hunt down the monstrous beast. Great glory awaited the one who could destroy the Caledonian boar. Many heroes came to the hunt, and also a girl whose name was Atalanta. She was the fastest runner in Greece, and a great huntress as well. When some of the men grumbled at hunting with a girl, Meleager ruled that a girl who could outrun them all would certainly be welcome to join the chase. Still grumbling, the men had to give in. For days the heroes feasted at the Caledonian court, Then they offered rich sacrifices to the gods and went off to the hunt. They drove the boar out of its lair, and as it charged, spears and arrows flew wild. When the dust settled, 7 men lay dead, some killed by the boar, some by the arrows of their excited companions. Atalanta alone kept a cool head. She ran swiftly hither and thither till she could take good aim, and then she let an arrow fly. The arrow stopped the boar just in time to save the life of a hero who had stumbled in front of the onrushing beast. Quickly Meleager leaped forward and hurled his spear with all his might. The beast rolled over and laid dead. Meleager offered the hide and the tusks to Atalanta. "These trophies were hers," he said, "for it was she who stopped the boar." Again the men protested, for it hurt their pride to see a girl walk off with all the glory. Meleager's 2 uncles teased him and said that he must be in love with the girl. "Just wait till your wife finds out about this," they said, smiling maliciously. In a rage, Meleager hurled his spear at his taunting uncles, killing them both. When Meleager's mother heard that her son had slain her 2 brothers, she too flew into a rage. She ran to her treasure chest and took out a half-charred log. It was a magic log that held Meleager's life. This log had been burning in the hearth when Meleager was born. The 3 fates had come to see the infant, and the mother had overheard them say it was a pity that the handsome child would die as soon as the log had burned up. Quickly the mother had seized the log, beaten out the flames, and had hidden it among her dearest treasures. Thus Meleager had lived to become a great hero. Now in her fury, the queen flung the old dry log into the fire. As it burst into flames and was consumed, Meleager felt a searing pain shoot through his body and fell dead. The Caledonian boar hunt, which had begun with a feast, ended with a funeral. Only Atalanta was happy. She had won her trophies in competition with the greatest heroes of Greece.
Atalanta, like Artemis, loved no men, though many men fell in love with her because she was so graceful when she ran. When she was born, her father had cruelly abandoned her in the wilderness, for he had hoped for a son. But she did not perish, for a she-bear heard her cries and carried her gently to her den, nursed her, and raised her with her cubs. Years later, an astonished huntsman saw a girl racing with wild beasts through the woods. He caught her in a snare and brought her home with him. Soon she learned to talk and act like a human, and her foster father was very proud of her fleetness of foot. He took her to athletic games, and she won all the races. Her fame spread over Greece, and now her real father proudly reclaimed her as his long-lost daughter. He was a king, and a king's daughter could not be allowed to run around unmarried, so he began to search for a suitable husband for her. But Atalanta did not want a husband. To be left in peace, she said she would only marry a man who could beat her in a running race. However, anyone who raced her and lost would forfeit his life. That would scare all the suitors away, she thought. But she was so lovely that many suitors tried their luck anyway, and they all lost their lives. One day, a young prince whose name was Melanion came to court her. He was smarter than the others. He knew he could not outrun Atalanta, so he sacrificed to Aphrodite and prayed for her help. The goddess of love, who wanted to see all pretty girls married, gave Melanion 3 golden apples and told him what to do. When the race began, Atalanta, certain she would win, let Melanion have a head start. When she caught up with him, Melanion threw a golden apple at her feet. It glittered so beautifully that she had to stop and pick it up. Soon she overtook him again, and Melanian threw a second apple, this time a bit further away. She left the track and made a dash.